Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic.
Larry.
I was expecting a little more than that, but that's to be fine. I'm glad to be with you. Thanks for inviting me out here. I want to thank our first speaker. I thought she did a magnificent job. And as Dave was saying, he's kept contact with me, close contact with me all year about coming out here. And he was really good about that. However, when I got to the airport and I was looking for somebody to pick me up, him and Lloyd could not be found. And they were out running around somewhere. And later when I got into the car, though, I seen all these bottles of energy drinks. And I figured that they were certainly busy doing something. So I'm glad to be here. If you're new in alcohol, I've got a busy head. I'm a loser in Alcoholics Anonymous, and really I don't have much going for me. And I've always been a loser, and I've got the type of head that the more tired I am, the more it wants to chat. And I could be physically beat, and my head will just want to chat. And that's all it did last night when I got in, man. You know, had that long flight, went to the room, got rid of Beavis and Butthead, and I just finally got to my room. I'm all ready to lay down. Couldn't go to sleep. My head wants to chat. 2:30 in the morning, my head, hey, let's chat, you know. I know you're up anyway, you know, and it started talking about when I was a baby and brought me right up to date, you know, and then I started worrying. I started thinking about the swimming pool in my backyard and if it was cracked, where all that water would go. You know, what happens to it? Does it go into the neighbor's yard or does it go underneath the house? You know, where does that water go? And that bothered me for a long time because I don't have a pool, you know. But I was thinking about getting one, you know, and I thought about that all night, you know, and I finally got a little bit of sleep, and I thought about going to see Chuck today and stuff like that. And for me, a lot of times, the only time where I can get peace of mind is with you. Sometimes the only peace of mind I have and can get are meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is why I look forward to coming to meetings, you know. And my sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 28 years and not amount to a damn thing. So I don't know where you think you're going if you're new, you know, but the highest I've ever gotten here was sober, basic human being, active member of my own home group, you know. And I'm always glad to be in a good meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It's where I belong. You know, for a long, long time, I didn't know where I belonged. And wherever I went, I never fit anywhere. Always feeling different, always comparing myself, never coming out a winner, you know. And when you're a loser like me and you're growing up, it seems like when you get into high school, people are always bringing people to your side to compare you to, you know. Why don't you try to be like Bobby? He's doing good, you know. And I remember being a freshman in high school and got drunk, and I'm in the principal's office, and me and my dad are sitting in there, and he sees on the side wall of the principal's office this picture of the star quarterback, number 7. My dad says, hey, why don't you try to be like him, jackass, you know? I says, all right, I'll give it a shot, you know. Next year, I got arrested for being drunk on campus again and loaded on some barbiturates, and I stole the janitor's cart, and I drove it through the library doors, you know. Had to get that book back, you know, and me and my dad and the probation officer are sitting in the principal's office, you know, and the principal's office sees this star quarterback, and he says, hey, why don't you try to be like Coy, you know? I said, all right, I'll give it a shot. Next year, my big sister starts dating some guy, and she brings it home, and it's old number 7 right there, and, you know, my mom comes running over in a moo-moo. You know, for God's sakes, why don't you try to be like Coy for, you know? And I said, all right, I'll give it a shot. My senior year, I'm getting ready to do 90 days in the Torrance Jail, and I'm sitting in there, and the somebody slides a newspaper in there, and it says that Coy makes all pro CIS. And I thought, God, I'd like to be like Coy. That guy's moving right along, you know. And then I'm about 5 years sober, and they say what goes around comes around in old A&A town, and I'm 5 years sober, and I'm driving around in my plumbing truck. I got the cardboard rolled up because I'm doing well. There's no windows, you know. And I'm at a stoplight, and it's vogue in Los Angeles that at every streetlight they got some guy selling oranges or peanuts, you know, and he's got this sign that says, I'll work for food, you know, like you don't, you know. And I look like a guy that needs help. People are always stuffing pamphlets in me, telling me about Jesus and Jehovah coming to town and stuff like that. And I'm at this stoplight, and this guy that's holding this sign locks eyes with me. And he starts making a beeline to the truck, and he pokes his head in my truck, and he goes, Larry, Larry Thomas. And I go, my God, Coy, that was him, you know. My God, I thought that guy had it made, you know. And then it dawned on me that if there was any justice in AA, that maybe my sponsor could write this guy a letter saying, why can't you be like Larry, you know what I mean? But that's been the story of my life, is everywhere I look, people have always looked like they got it together. Everybody looks like the answer to their life is some good, normal living. And I wouldn't know normal living if it bit me in the knee. But I was sure that that would be the answer to everything. And isn't it funny that you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and it looks like that's the answer here? You come to these meetings wherever you go. And to the untrained eye, it looks like people come here, they stop drinking, they get a little car, they get a little room, they get somebody to dance with. And to the untrained eye, it looks like the solution to our disease is normal living. And that could be further from the truth. There's nothing to be further from the truth. All it takes to get that stuff is some hard work and good fortune. But the solution to our disease will never be anything that has to do with the material. The solution to this disease will always be me, you, and that book, and the perpetuation of that gift. And I hope I never forget that. Because that is one of the things that diverts me from my primary purpose so many times, what is my primary purpose? And I get diverted, you know. And I don't have any reason for being an alcoholic. Whiskey played a big part of it, you know. I come from Detroit. Was brought out to California when I was about 4 years old, 3 or 4 years old, and put in a little foster home for a while. And my mom and dad got together. And my mom's a great lady. My mom's a little Scandinavian lady. And my mom loves speed. She was always eating that diet pills and running around the house, you know. Any hour of the day, she'd be running around the house, you know. And her favorite thing was to eat that speed and make these Afghans, you know. And everything in the house had fresh Afghans on it, you know. Couches had Afghans. Chairs had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads, you know. And if there was any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And you can hear, the house was small, and you can hear in the next room making the stuff just all night long, you know. Just a busy little thing, you know. And I knew my mom loved me. And make no mistake about that. I had no problem about that. Her favorite hobby was to get her prescription filled every month. She'd go down to Savon's drugstore, and she liked to take that speed and make these big jigsaw puzzles, these 30 million piece jigsaw puzzles, you know, of the Mojave Desert, you know. It's going to be a beige night, you know, and she'd go down there, cash in her prescription, get some peroxide for her hair, and get her a prescription and get that big pair. And then she'd buy these cigarettes, these Raleigh cigarettes, because they had the coupons on the back. And she saved those coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. And she'd run home and take some more speed and make this puzzle. She got a piece that didn't fit where she had a big pair of toenail clippers, and she'd snip that son of a bitch down till it did, you know. And just a busy lady, you know. And no matter what time you got up, she was up doing something, you know. I had no idea that I laid eyes on my first tweaker. I had no idea, you know. And I know there's none here tonight, you know. Everybody here has their real teeth, huh? Not you, buddy. You know. He's the only guy that was glad there was a shower in the men's room. I'm worried about you. You know. But and I love my mom to death, but I never want to forget, and it came out on a fourth and fifth step when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, is I never wanted to forget what I did back then and up to and after I come to Alcoholics Anonymous with anybody that would ever give me any love or affection, especially my mom and people close to me. And it started back then. I knew my mom loved me, and the thing that I started to do with anybody that would give me any love or affection or attention, I would play her like a fiddle. And there would never be a time that was going to be too inconvenient for me not to put the touch on that lady. And I never want to forget what it's like to be a young man, about 16 years old, and go to a little reform school for a short period of time, come out, my mom's waiting for me on a Monday morning, and I don't show up. No, he shows up on Wednesday. And where do I show up? I don't show up at home. I show up at my mom's place of business. I show up on a cold April morning, about 9 o'clock in the morning, with everything I got, everything I own on my back, and the rain hitting me in this parking lot of this dry cleaners. And my mom's about from here to that back door where that clock is right there. And I'm standing in this cold April morning, and the only thought that I have when I'm looking at that lady is she better have a buck. And I march through that cold rain, and I go into that lady's place of business, and one more time I'm to startle her with my presence, which would be an ongoing thing. And the only thing I ask her is for a dollar. And she breaks out that little wallet of hers that she probably got at Woolworths or something, and she starts thumbing through there, and the picture falls out when I'm about 8 years old on a Little League team, the only decent picture she'd ever have. And she gives me that $1 and $2, and I take it and I run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me, if you're new, is you take this same man and you bring him to Alcoholics Anonymous, where my life depends on it. Everything I do, my life depends on it. And you put me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you put the secretary of that meeting that same distance as me and my mom, and I need to ask you something. How come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that same distance and ask a man for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life? But I can walk that distance and use my mom and other people time and time and time and time again. And I'm here to share with you, if you're new, that it's been my experience that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. Make no mistake about that. Which is why it's necessary for a man with close to 28 years to still be close to and active in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, even more important than that, a home group. You see, I'm no big deal in my home group. They don't care I'm in Tampa, but they want their coffee made on Monday night, and I'm the cookie lady on Thursday night, and I'm a coffee, and a damn good-looking cookie lady, as you know, and a coffee pourer on Wednesday night. You see, because that's where I live, in my home group. That's where I've learned to carry this message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not from up here, from down there, in the middle of a home group. From out there, in a place called a job. From out there, in a place called a home. You see, if you're new, what I do in between meetings has everything to do with me being what type of member I am. What I'm like when I leave you has everything to do with what type of AA member I am when you're not looking. And I learned everything about being a decent man and a decent husband and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous right here with you. Everything that I've ever needed to make my life what it is today, I found in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see? I'm the type of drunk that I was so glad that you guys talked about God. Because by the time I got to you, that's all I had. There wasn't anything left. And that seems to be the common denominator with people that come here and stay. There's just nothing else left for you to do. And that seems to be the only thing you have left. And so I am deeply grateful that you guys talked about God. I'm deeply grateful that you guys got together when you didn't want to be together and put on your meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's something about AA you need to know. Be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, I tell you, because nothing's about what is up to you if you, you know, you're feeling good. This is about doing the uncomfortable to get comfortable. You know? How many people couldn't wait to get here tonight? You know what I mean? I mean, we go because we know that something's going to happen to us when we're here. You know? It ain't about how we feel about going, you know? And I grew up with this mom and dad, and my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a World War II vet. My dad was happy, singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. My dad used to drink and like loved to sneak into his own damn house, you know. And it was always through my bedroom window, you know. He's a refinery worker. He's got these big boots on. You can see him sneaking through that window and foot coming down on my chest, you know. And I grabbed it one night and I said, hey, I said, you know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know. She's up anyway, for God's sake, you know. I mean, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. And my dad, you know, my dad reeked of being a good, strong man, you know. And my dad used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it. You know, back when I was your age, we really had it tough. And, man, he nailed me. I've never known how good I've had it. I've never come out of the chute wrapped with gratitude. I got to be beaten half to death today to be grateful for the simple life that I have. And my dad used to tell you don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, we really had it tough. And he did. He had a heck of a life. His mother died at an early age. She was a drunken whore. She hung herself in a Detroit jail. His father choked on his tongue in a convulsion, died when he was a young man. And his dream was to go into the Navy, marry my mom, get her out of that convent, bring her back to California and leave the good life. And their dream was to have a family and raise them as such that they will never have to want for anything. He didn't want me to want for anything. And so that's why they both worked a lot and they were never around. And he didn't have a, you know, a big deal about how I was feeling today or anything like that, you know. You did things wrong, you got punished and stuff like that. But the thing that was so baffling about my dad was how easy he made it look by being a good man. I'm the type of guy that doing good doesn't make me feel good. Doing good may make you feel good, I'm doing good, but doing good has no long-lasting effect on me, whether just to think that, man, you know, there's got to be more to it than this. And my dad wanted me to be just a good guy and have character, and at the age of 11 years old, sobriety stopped working. I had enough of good character, you know what I mean? And I knew that my old man found something when he was drunk. He was a happy drunk. He was a miserable man when he was sober. But at 11 years old, there was four of us. We were running around in a garage, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, my head shut off. For the first time in my life, I knew what peace of mind was. For the first time in my life, I didn't have that roaring going on in my stomach and my head. You know, and it turned Howdy Doody into James Dean in three drinks, you know. And rolled up my cigarettes and marched out there the next day, you know. And I started, you know, I took two shots of that stuff and it started throwing it up, coming out of my nose. My ears were ringing, peeing my pants, saying, I got to have some more of that, you know. And I, you know, I didn't head out to Skid Row that next day or anything like that. But I never forgot the place that I was in that night. Because for the first time in my life, everything was right with me. Everything was right with me for that little snot-nosed kid. I didn't have to worry about what the old man felt about me, what anybody felt. For the first time in my life, I found peace of mind. And that was to be my reference point. And the trouble with this alcoholic is I would never find that peace of mind that I found when I was drinking sober. No matter what I did or where I went, I would never feel that way. I'd always be a little bit restless and irritable and discontented, always doubting myself, always comparing myself, always wondering why everybody gets along with each other and they seem to be talking with each other and I can't. Never able to integrate myself with anybody around me, always feeling that mysterious barrier between me and my fellows. And I would do everything physically that they were doing, and they seemed to be content with normal living, and I can do everything they're doing, play football, run, and stuff like that, but I'm not getting that contentment out of it. There's always got a missing piece going on with me, and I'm always wondering what's wrong with me. And like I said, I didn't, you know, head out to Skid Row that next day, but I got the address. That's for damn sure, you know. And it wasn't hard to get. Wherever I'd go, my dad had it hidden in the garage and stuff like that. And whenever I would feel restless, irritable, or had to face some form of responsibility, I knew I could take a shot of my old man's wine. And he always had his Thunderbird wine in there in the garage, you know. And got into high school and started dating this little Mexican girl, you know. And I love cars, you know. I love lowered cars. I love to drop my car down to the ground, you know. We used to get our hair up real big, like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, you know, and lower our cars down. And listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it. We'd drive around with our white T-shirts and black khaki pants that come up to here, you know. Women were telling me men who were well endowed had big feet. I had a pair of 15-inch shoes I was driving around in, you know. Got my big hair and my big feet, and, you know, got a smile on my face because my ass hurts from driving around all night, you know. And I was in my plumbing truck the other day, and I heard the Four Tops, and I just start sinking in my damn truck, and I loved it, you know. I had a little Mexican girl named Loopy. She had her hair all curled up, and her curls were so big that sometimes she used to curl them with soup cans. Sometimes those noodles were stuck in there, you know, and we'd drive around and wonder what the hell you're looking at, you know, and drinking our Thunderbird wine, and God, I loved it, man. I remember one night we were drinking that 151 rum, rolled up into this Jack-in-the-Box restaurant. She says, "Well, talk to the puppet, you know," and I can't see the puppet, you know, I can hear him, "Can I have your order, please," you know, and I cover my eye, looking for the puppet, you know, and I turn this corner, I hear this big crash, and this puppet's head's hanging down like that, you know, and I run over the puppet, the cops come, they arrest me, they throw me on the hood of the car, they shatter my hair all over the place, you know, I don't drive till I'm 30, you know, big deal, let Rudy drive all night, you know, he's not doing anything anyway, and there's nothing like riding shotgun, there's nothing like riding shotgun while the other guy's driving and you're drinking, you get to bounce around, drink that cheap wine, and make that magnificent discovery, how good looking you look in that little mirror. Oh, there's nothing better looking than an alky that's drinking. I tell you, that's the only reason they put those mirrors on in those bars, man, so that we can be captured by our own magnificence, man. Oh, my God, are you good looking, man. And I take a look at myself in that mirror and I go, my God, what are you hanging around these Mexicans for, you know? You ought to be an underwear model or something like that, you know? You don't wear any, but what the hell, you know? And you look at yourself in that mirror and your hair's all big and slanted because you've been sleeping on the car door, you know? You got some cigarette butt stuck in there. You got 30 pounds of throw-up and puke on your tank top, you know? And I feel like dancing when I look like that. I don't know about you, you know? Drive over to Shanghai Reds and you go bouncing in there and you got that 151 rum all over you and you got to let them know you've been drinking, you know. You got to let them know you got it on, you know, and you're looking for your salsa queen. And there she is, man. She's over by the bar. She's looking at herself in that mirror because she can't believe how good looking she is either, you know. And she's got her hair up real big. She's got flies stuck in her hair. She's got about 30 pounds of tamale puke on her chest, you know, and she's over there gnawing on a pickled pig feet, and I like that about a woman, you know. And I figured I got to have that gal, you know. So I go walking over with my big feet and my big ideas, you know, honking on her with that 151 rum, you know, and I start putting it on her, and her lesbian girlfriend comes over and beats the snot out of me, you know. And I've got these big feet, and they're stuck between the foot rail and the bar, and I can't get out, man. And this old bag is just, bam, knocking me out. I can't get away, and she's, bam, you know. And I had no idea I was a victim of gay bashing, you know what I mean? But for 3 hours, she kicked the snot out of me, you know. And the only thought that I have is when this bag is done, I'm going to kick her ass, you know. I couldn't get out of there, you know. Well, I wore her down, and I finally took my little salsa queen home, you know, and we partied that night, and next morning I got up, and I had to take this little 90-year-old woman home, you know. Leave those tanks, come on, you know. But I tell you, man, I loved every part about drinking. I loved drinking, man. Drinking saved my life, man. It took a snot-nosed little kid and put him smack dab in the middle of what he thought was life. And every time I drank that stuff, it was like stepping through the big, pretty window, man. It was like stepping into the most beautiful little picture you've ever seen. And everything was good with me and everybody in around me. And the trouble with this alcoholic is that it was like that for a long time. And that every time I took a shot of anything, I would walk into the big, beautiful window. And after three drinks, you kick open that phenomenon of craving. And after that, it's just about keeping that thing going. Keep it going, man, because you are in a spot that you know you just can't believe, you know. And the trouble with my life is that the longer I drink, the smaller that window got. And the smaller that window got. And the smaller that window got. And by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't drinking for a big picture window. I was drinking because of a thought that maybe this time I can get that thing to open up again. This time I'll answer my phone. And I wasn't drinking for it. I was just drinking for the hope that maybe this time it'll be different. You see, that's the curse of this alcoholic. Isn't the jails and the institutions. What makes me an alcoholic is that I have the ability that every time I get sober, I can look over 20 years of drinking and I can see every face of everybody that I've harmed, hurt, abused, been abused by. I can see every little thing that I've ever done to everybody. I'm the type of drunk that every time I get sober, I can see the mental things that are happening to me and the physical consequences, the blood, the things swelling, stuff. I can see all that. I'm the type of drunk that every time I get sober, I know about the consequences that face me, the institutions and the jails. I know all about that. But there's one thing that I can't get over, that every time that I stop drinking, I have the ability, no matter how bad that last drunk, it never has sufficient force to keep me sober. In fact, I'm the type of drunk that every time I get sober, no matter how bad that last drunk is, it's just a matter of weeks or days or months, I happen to come up with a profound conclusion that this time it's going to be different. This time it ain't going to get me. Knowing perfectly well what happened to me that time and the time before, I've got the ability to push all that stuff, sound knowledge aside, just for the thought that maybe this time it'll be different, and having no proof that it will, except a memory back in 1965 when that stuff worked real good. I never had any dreams my whole life. The only dream that I ever had was this time it's going to be different. I lived for that dream, and that dream damn near killed me because it had me my entire life. Everything in my life was predicated about that thought. And I couldn't manage a life because everything that I thought, felt, or knew about was about the possibility of thy next drunk. And by the time I got out of high school, everybody was going different places, Vietnam and stuff like that. And I thought, well, maybe I'll take my buddy and we'll go to Detroit and find my roots. And we head off to Detroit and we wound up in Phoenix. You know, and I'm over there in Phoenix at the Apache Hotel. It's about five floors high. Everybody's got a TV. It's in the lobby. Everybody's got a bathroom. It's down the hall. It's about $30 a month. I don't have any money to pay it. I'm in a little room about the size of a 20 by 20 little room with a Murphy bed and a hot plate and a hot TV. I'm looking out of a little window, drinking and dreaming and dying, knowing that maybe one of these days I'll get my life in some kind of order. Maybe if I can just get a job and everything at once, everything will be all right. Waiting for the wagon wheel bar to open up. Waiting up all night for that bar to open up, you know. Go down there, meet my people. It didn't have any windows at the bar, it just has a curtain. You go in there and you plan your life. And I meet a guy in there named Ernie. And he says, I know what we're going to do. He says, I got a buddy that owns a plumbing company. Why don't you come by here tomorrow morning? He says, we'll get you a job. So I show up there and he introduces me to this guy. He says, yeah, I'll put you to work. Takes me out there and sticks me underneath the house. He said, now don't you come out of there. He says, all I want you to do under there is string copper. Just hang copper all day. And after about 9 hours, I'll come and get you. And he gave me a little transistor radio. I had a pint of Kessler's. There was this little abandoned stray cat under there looking at me, you know, wondering what the hell I'm doing in his house, you know. And the guy took off. 9 hours later, I'm totally drunk. They're dragging me out underneath that house. Apparently, I got drunk and busted up through the bedroom, stole the lady of all of her money and jewelry. They dragged me out, you know, and I'm underneath the house, and I'm thinking I got it made. I mean, my God, you know, I got a pint, I got a radio, got a pet, you know, I mean, I'm on top of the world under there, you know, I never had it so good, you know, and I just started drinking that whole thing, man, and 9 hours later, they dragged me out of there and stole all that lady's jewelry, the cat comes running out, it's got a bunch of necklaces on, you know, and so, you know, I lose that job, go back to the bar. He introduces me to a guy named Ernie, and Ernie's from Tennessee. I know what we're going to do, Larry. He says, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds, and you're going to be a jockey. And I go, wow. I says, you know, and I'm ready for some exercise and working out, you know. And he says, yeah, we'll get you down to 95 pounds, and we'll go weigh you in and get our colors. It'll take about 2 months. And he gave me a bag of meth, some speed. Now, I don't do that. You know, I've just been drinking and doing heroin, minding my own business, you know. And this guy gave me this stuff. I didn't know what it was, you know, but he took off. And he says, I'll be back in, you know, 2 months. And he came back in 2 weeks. And I haven't moved an inch. I'm just, you know, I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any damn horse I've ever seen in my life, you know. You can put a saddle on my ass and ride me around here, you know. I didn't, you know, all I would get is take that stuff and chase a fly around my room, you know. Come on, son of a bitch, I'll get you, you know, and look out my window every 10 seconds. What's that? What's that? What's that? You know, and all I seen was these black and white flashes driving me nuts, you know, and hell, it was the sun going up and down is what it was, you know. He comes back, he says, you couldn't have possibly taken all that. I said, I did, and I need some more right now, you know. I'm all sucked in, anything white on the ground, I'm firing it up, you know. It could have been a toenail, man. I'm calm, baby. You know, I didn't know what the hell was going on. It was 16 days of my life, man, you know. Went down to the wagon wheel bar, hooked up with another plumber. He worked me for an hour and a half. I found out he was younger than me. And I thought, well, I'm not working for no kid. So I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. Took me to the county hospital. Got me, you know, on the way down there, got me another pint of Kessler's. Walked into the county hospital. They looked at me. They gave me a prescription for some Percodan. They left the room, and there was a box of prescription pads that it looked like they didn't need. So I took those, and me and Ernie started writing prescriptions and met up with some guys in Tucson, and before you know it, we started writing prescriptions, and getting drunk and writing them for Secanol and Tylenol and Nebutol and you name it all. I wrote it all, you know, and damn near took it all, too, you know. And after about 9 months, they caught up with me, and when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase, you know, like they got a, there he goes, down to 17, you know, none of that happening, you know. Just a matter of the sheriff coming into the busy B hotel going, there he is under there, you know. Butt naked, too. What the hell is going on? You know, so they arrested me and put me, no, I'm not a big-time convict. I'm just another little loser trying to make the best of what I had, you know. And about 8 months later, they gave me a voucher to come back to Los Angeles. Went to the L.A. City Hall. And while I was over in Phoenix, me and my partner were at this lake, Sawara Lake, and we were both loaded on that 151. And he was out there and on the water, and he fell off his raft, and I let him drown. He wasn't but about 20 feet from me, and I let him drown. And I couldn't dive. I tried to dive after him, and all I seen was mud. And the only thought that I have is, now I can have his dope. And I let him drown. I couldn't see him. And I went looking for him again. But I couldn't. I didn't have it in me to look after him anymore. That damn near killed me. This guy was about twice my age. And he hooked up with me when I was a kid in high school. And I would do anything for this guy to get that dope. And he started doing some indecent things and some pictures and selling them to Mexico. But you see, I was getting some dope. And the thought that came with me when he was dying, I'm so glad to get him out of my life. I didn't know how to tell you that when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was so busy hiding behind an image. But these are the things that I don't tell you for any type of bravado or anything. But these are the types of things that kept me in bondage to self. These are the type of things that I didn't know that I could get rid of here. These are the type of things that the nightmares kept me up. I know what it's like to be sober and not sleep. I know what it's like to have pictures and faces of people. that no matter how much you drink and how much you stay sober, you can't get them out of your head. They're with you all the time. And I left Phoenix and I come out and come back to California in 1974. They gave me a little voucher for a hotel in downtown Torrance, $24 a month hotel. In 1974, I'm on Anabuse. And I'm going for this job over there in El Segundo, California. I can't drive. And I got about 3 hours before I go to work. And I go to a Little League dugout. And I don't have any drugs or alcohol in me for about 3 months. And I'm in a Little League dugout. And I go absolutely out of my mind. In between hysterical and maniacal, my paranoia is so bad that I start hallucinating. And I'm in a place I'd never been to before. And I know I'm not coming back. And all these people take me, and from what I understand, they called the paramedics, and they took me to the Harbor General Hospital in Carson, California. They look at my jacket, and they diagnose that some of my drug overdoses may have been suicide attempts, and by the looks of some of the things that are going on, that I need to go to a state asylum for about 60 days to be observed. And so they sent me to be observed, and I got out a year later. Totally observed. And they gave me all the medication they could keep a guy afloat with. And it took care of a lot of things. But you know one thing they can't medicate away? This time it's going to be different. You can't take that out of a guy. You can't take that out of an alcoholic. They did everything they could to erase my past. Everything they could possibly think of for me to be free of my past. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And by golly, you know that that's the thing that saved my life today? Is that my past has become my greatest asset. I am so glad they couldn't cook that out of my head. I am so glad they didn't take that away from me. Because I can't tell you how many inventories that I've listened to where that seems to be the common thread between me and that man sitting across from me. I'm so glad they couldn't take those away, you know. And I come out of that hospital about a year later, and they gave me my little bag of stuff to take. And I lasted about 2 months, and they find me over at O'Vero Street in downtown Los Angeles. A public nuisance. A public drunk. Rolled up behind a 76 station. The cops came, they arrested me, they got me on a violation, they sent me up to Wayside County Ranch again, and I'm up there for about 50 days. And they put about 40 of us in a black and white bus, took us for a 5-mile drive where I'm going to be sentenced to an institution. And at the end of the day, I made a holding tank about this size, just me and bologna sandwiches. A concrete floor, my Vons bag, and no hope. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody's gone. All the other guys are gone. All the buses are gone. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm wondering where they're going to send me now. Because they're always sending me somewhere. And I'm thinking, you know, where are they going to send me now? And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch opened up a jail door. He said, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He said, "Why don't you come with me, son? We're going to AA." I said, "My God, what's that? I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA, you know? And who's the Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know?" And you know, looking back 27 years, you know who that Scottish pirate was? He was my first vision of a trusted servant. And what made this man a trusted servant was that he had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel. He wasn't part of a H&I panel or a counselor or a probation officer or anything. The guy was a refinery worker, and he just got the worst news of his life, that his wife was dying immediately of a terminal disease. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But see, somewhere in his meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, somewhere in his home group and his book studies and his 12 and 12, that guy was able to sit and listen and grasp and develop a manner of living that hammered in him this, that practical experience tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics, that this works when other activities fail. And that thought came to him, and he turned his little car around, and he went to the South Bay Courthouse. He talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they said, I think we got a guy for you. And he went down to that holding tank, and he said, are you Larry Thomas? And I said, he said, come with me, son, you're going to AA. And that little Scottish pirate took me to my first meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch or something, you know. He took me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. 15 minutes, he bounces up to this little, dingy, stinky, smelly Alano club. And I'd never seen that word before, Alano. What the hell's an Alano? You know, is that like some kind of animal, like an elk or an eagle or something, you know? And watch for crossing Alanos, you know? And he pulled up to this Alano club, and there they were, all walking around, all the Alanos, you know, and started introducing me to all these goofy people, man. Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people. You know, I figured, my God, I just left a group of people like this. You know what I mean? And little Moose come running after me. Hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are. I said, I'm not it, that's for sure, you know. And big transvestite came out of the card room. He starts circling me like a helicopter in Los Angeles, you know. And he finally lands. He comes walking over in his moo-moo, you know. Hi, I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting. I says, I don't think so, big fella, you know. Not till I get a year anyway, that's for sure, you know. I said, my God, if that's AA, I don't want any part of that. And if that's the effect of that big blue book, I'm not going to crack that thing open either. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. And the biggest lie that I told myself was that I was coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't touched AA. Hadn't done a thing here. What I did is what I'd done my entire life. What would it make any difference because I'm with you? What I did is something I did my entire life. I sat in a room waiting for somebody to do something to me. I sat in a room waiting for people to do something for me. And I was no different here. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, what you're waiting to be done to you, God's waiting to do through you. And I had no idea. I had no idea that everything that I need in Alcoholics Anonymous was going to have to start with me. That it was an action program. But you see, that's what I've done my entire life, man. Waiting for people to do something to me. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you don't change, man, your sobriety date will. That's the only thing that will change. Because I can't stay sober and live my old lifestyle. You see, when I think about sobriety today, I don't think about drugs and alcohol or the absence of anything in my system. When I think about my sobriety today, I think about the way I live. I think about how I live today and how impossible it is to live the way I live, the way I used to live, and stay sober. But if I live this way that you teach me, that there's nothing that other than staying sober can happen if you live this way. And I had no idea. And I came in and out of your rooms from 1975 to 1982, worst years of my life, slipping in and out of AA, getting physically sober and mentally ill. Can't stay drunk and you can't stay sober, destined to look for that middle-of-the-road answer. No one likes to admit because he's a real alcoholic. Why? Because you may have to do something about it. See, I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety drives me to drink time and time and time again. I can't stand the way that I feel when I'm sober. And the longer I stay sober, the worse I feel. And I come to these meetings and I see these guys with these ties on saying stuff like, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. You know, I'm going, my God, I came in with that guy, you know. And everybody seems to be getting their life together. And I'm a type of alcoholic, man. That sobriety is not my friend. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're sober and you're not doing AA, or if you're an old-timer and you're not doing AA, that's the worst place an alcoholic can be, is not drinking and not doing AA. There is nothing worse than living in that flat spot expecting that tomorrow is going to be different because you wish it to be, you know? And on May 2nd, 1980, I'm up at the Don Hotel in downtown Wilmington. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me. And they're always clean and they're sharp, which is why I wear a tie tonight. I wear a tie tonight because people in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to get a job and show respect for the thing that's saving my life. Because every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody came and got me, and they were clean and they were sharp. And in 1980, I'm at the Don Hotel, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even call AA. I got 15 days sober, and I hear this knock on the door. I'm watching Jeopardy. I got a half pint of bourbon cut in half. I got a bottle of bourbon cut. I'm watching Jeopardy so I could really feel like an idiot, you know. And 10 o'clock in the morning, I hear this knock on the door. Larry, it's Don. I'm going, my God, it's that guy from AA, you know. I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here, you know. And he opens up the door, and he's going, oh, my God, what are you doing, kid? He had 15 days, you know. And I took a shot of that bourbon. I told him, you know, get the hell out of my room. I don't want what you got. I don't want what you have. If I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do. Why don't you just get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do? The cry of this alcoholic, my entire life, let me do what I want to do. And the moment that I said that, it shot a cord in the back of my neck that shot me back to 1967 when me and my dad are fighting. He's kicking me out of the house because I'm getting drunk and selling dope at high school. And he says, I don't care what you do with your life. But you're not going to do that here. I've got a wife and two daughters. And me and my dad starts fighting. I make physical contact with my father. And it would be something that I joked around with the guys, but it would be one of the first things on my inventory was the shame I felt for hitting my dad. And how from that point on, I would start building this brick wall between me and my dad because I didn't know how to make amends for that. It shot me back to 1969 when my mom's alone in an apartment, and I'm on one of my drunken runs, and I break in on my mom, and it's about 1 o'clock at night, and my mom's on the couch. And my mom lays me down on the couch, and she starts rocking. She puts my head on her lap, and she starts crying. And I got my head on her lap, and I can feel these tears hitting me as she tells me, she says, you know, dear God, please help my baby boy. And I get up, and I tell mom, it ain't that bad. And she runs off to bed. And I remember her having a bottle in the kitchen sink. And I start looking for that bottle. I start tearing up that lady's kitchen. And I can't find it. And she comes out of her room. She says, honey, what's wrong? And I said, don't you, honey, what's wrong with me? And I start beating up my mom till I get blood out of her nose, demanding that she come up with the bottle. That she had no idea was there. Just for me to pass out, to wake up in the morning and see that the empty was in the trash. On May 2nd, 1982, I check into the Beacon Light Mission. I'm not going there to get sober. I'm not going there because there's a recovery home in there. I'm going because that's where I live. I'm going there because I can sing some Jesus hymns and get a plot of beans. That's what I do. And on May 2nd, 1982, I go by this werewolf window and I catch eyes with the thing. And the thing's about 120 pounds and he's yellow. He's got everything he owns on his back. And I'm not drunk. I'm stone cold sober, and I lock eyes with the thing. And I've been dodging that thing my entire life. I don't have mirrors. I don't look in reflections. I scar myself. I don't do anything. And I catch eyes with the thing, and there I am. The sum total of my will. The sum total of me running my life, staring right back at me. And I did what I always did when I looked that way. I panhandled some money and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And who do I get? I get Don. I said, Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the Beacon Light Mission. I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He said, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty ass down here? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love? You know, well, hell, I just heard it. For the first time in my life, it was up to me to come to you. It was no longer necessary for the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous to be inconvenienced with my nonsense. It was up to me to come to you. And I started walking that 10 miles with my poopy pants and no hope. And every step of the way, my head was saying, you ain't going to make it. You've been here before. This ain't going to work. Come over here and get a bottle. Come over here and steal a bottle. Come over here and do this. Every step of the way. And every step of the way, it kept convincing me that I was the alcoholic. By the time I got to that Alano Club 10 miles later, I had conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And in the case for me, it was this. It wasn't that I'm an alcoholic, I'm not going to drink. It wasn't an alcoholic, you shouldn't drink. What I learned in that walk is that I'm an alcoholic and I'm going to drink. And everything in me faced that way. And I'm the type of alcoholic that no longer how long I stay sober, I'll never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back to you. And I don't ever want to forget what it's like to stare through your windows and look in your meetings and wonder if I ever have a piece of this thing. Because that's where I spent my entire life. Watching life from a room, watching life go by me like a train, wondering how do you hop on this thing? You see? Now the funny thing about the obsession to drink with alcohol, we come here and we work these steps and we surrender, and before you know it, this obsession to drink is removed. What a relief for the alcoholic. What a dream for the alcoholic. Well, how come people who've had it removed, how come they still drink? Because the obsession to drink will never come back as a form of a drink. The obsession to drink doesn't come back in a form of a drink. The obsession to drink comes back in a form of, I don't need to do this anymore. Let somebody else go make the pizza. Let somebody else go make the ziti. Let somebody else pick up the speaker, or at least try to dodge them. It comes in the form of, I don't got to do this. That is the biggest hurdle for the alcoholic who is sober of our type. The biggest hurdle isn't drinking. The biggest hurdle is the simplicity of the program. It's just too baffling to them. This thing is so damn simple that we sit around thinking there's got to be a tougher way to do it, and by God, I'm going to figure out what it is. The simplicity of it all is baffling. What that guy told me, that Scottish guy with the patch, practical experience of it. Nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. That's the key to life. You want to get sober, work with other alcoholics. You get a divorce, work with other alcoholics. You get married, work with three or four alcoholics, you know what I mean? But we don't have different answers for different problems. The answer is the same for whatever is ailing you. The young lady was talking about having a spiritual experience. You know what I got as a result of these steps? You know what my experience was? That the search was over. The search was over, and I'd always been searching my entire life. And by the time I got done with these steps, I realized with my sponsor that everything that I need to make me happy will be given to me by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And anything that hinders that happiness will be removed by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Your search is over. My God, I can rest with that. I'm so tired of looking. I'm so tired of looking. And all I got to do is come to Tampa. All I got to do is show up at my home group. You see, they say home is where the heart is. And my heart's in my home group. You see, because on a May 2nd, 1982, somebody got off their rusty ass when they didn't want to, when they were warm and cozy, and they came up and they made the coffee, and they put the meeting together, and they set up the literature, and they put the tables together, and they got their ties on, and the tapers were here. All these people did that. And it's my privilege now to recreate that atmosphere. And you know why we do that? You know why we get together and do that, newcomer? Not so that we can come up here and brag. It's because so that if you're new, when you come to our meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have to do anything. Everything's been done for you. All you need to do is sit in your seat and listen to the sweet voice of a loving God that's expressed himself in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And hopefully, you'll identify, and hopefully you'll say, damn it, I can do this thing too. Everything's done for you, man. We're waiting for you. That's a hell of a thing for a guy like me. What a thing we have here. I don't think this thing was created just so we can come here, get sober, and get our jobs and take off. I don't think that's what those guys were. When you look at the picture with those two guys talking to that guy on the bed, the most magnificent picture in Alcoholics Anonymous, you think they're talking to that guy about, well, Rusty, you better get back to work. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about perpetuating this gift. This isn't about coming and getting. It's about coming and giving. And we create an atmosphere like this so that the newcomer can look around and go, my God, man, maybe I can do it here. Maybe I can do it here. These folks seem to be happy, joyous, and free. Maybe I can do it here, man. Give a guy a little bit of hope. There's nothing like that. You can build mountains with a little bit of hope. And I had no idea, and I took that 10-mile walk, and I walked into this little dingy Alano club, and there was that Montana cowboy. And I walked up to that guy, and I asked him something I never asked him for 10 years. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. I don't know what to do with my life. I said, would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 10 seconds, and then he leaned into me for about a half hour, you know. Told me no uncertain terms was he going to put up with my nonsense. And then he gave me my Declaration of Independence for sponsorship. You make the effort, I'll make the effort. You don't make the effort, don't bother me. Because there's nothing worse than dragging people through their sobriety. Are you going to the meeting tonight? Are you going to call me tomorrow? Are you going to read that book? No, he wouldn't put up with that nonsense. You make the effort, I'll make the effort. You don't make the effort, don't bother me, son. I've got guys that want to stay sober. And that guy was my sponsor for a year and a half. And I started backing away from that. And we went through the steps. But after about a year, year and a half, I started noticing my sponsor's imperfection. My hero, my idol, started showing his humanness to me. And I was scared. And I started judging my sponsor. He became a human being with his imperfections. And I started judging my sponsor, and I started holding secrets. And I started backing away. And at 2 years sober, I'm going to meetings, and I got a gun after I leave. I don't know where to jump in front of the bus or what the hell. I go to my meetings, and for an hour and a half, I put my AA face on. And after the meetings, I go to my room and die because I'm running my own life. I'm filled with every obsession there is. I think that's going to fix me. And at 2 years sober, a guy comes down and he tells me what I am. He says, you're an AA pimp. You're a loser. He says, there's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous, son. I hope you find it. And I followed that guy. Not because of who he was. I didn't know who he was. But he had a belief in AA that I wanted. Because I never believed in anything my entire life with me. And that maybe this time it'll be different. And I followed that guy to a home group. And that guy's my sponsor today. He's been my sponsor for 25 years. And he introduced me to a home group and the value of a home group and the love of a home group. And for a long, long time, that home group was your home group. And I felt like a guest. But then I started staying a while and I started getting commitments. And then it became my home group. And then you started teaching me some traditions and it became our home group. Our common problem, our primary purpose, our Father God. And you guys taught me the value of a home group, and that man took me through these steps, and we started making amends to some people that deserved it. Forget the dope dealer. He says, you've got some mothers and fathers and some parents that you need to make amends to. And there was nothing like making amends to my father. There was nothing like becoming my father's best. You can always tell when something is worth doing is that the end result is you become friends with people you hated. And this man that I hated, I made amends to my dad, and it took more than an afternoon and a note. I started having chili every Thursday night with my dad, and that was our night. And I would go, and there would be long, quiet nights with me and dad, or afternoons. But eventually we started talking, and I stopped talking to him about AA. There's nothing more boring than for them to hear about Bob and Bill. You know what I mean? I started talking to my dad about what interests him. And we started enjoying these afternoons and going to Dodger games. We started becoming friends, good buddies. And by the time my dad passed away a couple years ago, we were best of friends. And he let me take care of him while he was dying. And he said, son, let me die in my own home. Don't let him come and get me. And I said, don't worry, Dad. They won't come and take you. And it was my job that every time the people from the state or hospice came by, that as long as my dad was standing, they couldn't take him away. And so every time he would come, I'd put his Dodger hat on him and we'd prop him up. And he got this pass in his own home. And every time I would see my dad, I would do like I did with our friend Chuck today. I would say, hi, Dad, I love you. And I would kiss him on the forehead. Now, where would a guy learn that? I learned that in a home group in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, where at the end of every meeting, we hold hands with men and we pray to this loving God. And once a month, I'll give a guy a cake, or maybe my sponsor will give me a cake, and he'll kiss me on the cheek and say, I love you, son. And I'll give a guy a hug and someone on his birthday. And you know, when it came time for me to show affection to my father, I could do it without feeling weird, because I've been doing it every week with you. And that day that my dad died, they took him away, and I called my sponsor, and he says, well, come on down, son. And for a couple weeks, I didn't know what to do with my Thursdays. And then one Thursday, I got a call about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was my sponsor. He says, Larry, what are you doing, son? I says, well, I says, I'm getting ready to come to our 12 and 12 in a couple hours. He says, why don't you get in your car, come by and get me. Let's go have some chili. And that's what me and my sponsor have been doing ever since. He says, I never had a son. And if I ever did, he says, you'd be the closest thing to it, Larry. He says, but there's one thing you have to know about me, son. He says, there's nothing you can do to make me love you anymore. And there's nothing you can do to make me love you any less. I just love you, Larry. All I want you to do is carry this message wherever you go. That's all I want you to do, son. And that's all I've been trying to do. Because it's the best life I've ever had. Now, what did I do with that mother who I gave a bloody nose to and startled her half to death? But I tell you, I've been a happily married man for 11 years now, but every week I cheat on my wife. I date my mom. I go over and I see that lady. And for a long, long time, she wouldn't hug me. She'd put up her arms, but she's scared to death of me. But because of continuation, continue to work these steps, continue to show up, continue to show her the program of alcohol, she's no longer, you were able to give me back her peace of mind that I robbed from. And she don't got to worry about where I'm at. And she can call me up and I can take her to the hospital. You know? There was not too far, she had an operation not too long ago. She had a hernia operation. And they had to go in. And she was scared and she called me. And my sponsor says, my God, he says, why don't you go over there and reassure her for God's sakes, you know? You can go around talking. Why don't you talk to your mom about this operation? Go over and see her. So I went over and talked to my mom and I told her, Mom, it's a simple operation. It's like getting your tonsils out. Don't even worry about it. And I gave her this big pep talk. She went in for the operation. The next day it went south. They found all kinds of stuff. I went down to visit her. Went up to the nurse's station. They said, are you Betty's son? And I said, yeah. Well, she wants to talk to you. And I went into this room and she was all laid out. She had all these hoses going on. She looked up at me and she went. I got down to her ear and she says, tonsils my ass, you know. I brought my little flower. But on the way over there, I called my wife, Rosie. And she says, why don't you go over there and just give her a little massage? Women love to be touched. And so I thought about that on my way over there, and I stopped at the gift shop. And while I was at the gift shop, I got this big jar of lavender cream, and I took it up to my mom's room. And while I was standing there, I said, Mom, I said, would you like your feet massaged? And her feet popped out of the blankets, and they just, you know. And I started massaging my mom's feet. And she's going, ooh, oh, scared the shit out of me. I'm going, easy, Mom, you know. And, you know, it shot me back to when I was a dirty little kid, how she used to rub that Cornhuskers lotion on my elbows and stuff like that, and how good I felt, and how neat it was to touch my mom in a gentle way. Because I'd never done that. And how she was able to let me do that. I seen my mom a couple weeks ago, and she lives up in this retirement place, and all the ladies got these identical rooms, right? And they all got balconies, and they all got flowers on their balconies. And I'm sitting there, and I notice that my mom's got plastic flowers, and all these other ladies got real flowers. I said, "Mom, why don't you let me get you some plastic flowers or some real flowers?" She says, "No, I don't want them. I like my plastic flowers." I says, "No, I'll build you a planter and I'll put in some new roses." She goes, "I don't want any real roses." I says, "You don't got to pay for it, Mom. I'll take care of everything. I'll put you some real roses and some real lilies, and you can have real flowers." She says, "I don't want real flowers." She says, "I love my plastic flowers." She says, "I love to sit here and watch the hummingbirds suffer." I said, "All right, we'll let you have that." I tell you, there was a little girl I had when I was 5 years sober. I got married for a year and a half. And I had a baby daughter, my daughter Lauren. And a month ago, I went over to Arizona because that's what I do. I see my little girl. The women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, "You may not be somebody's husband, but you'll always be somebody's father." Don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at. And she's never had to. Because I write her letters and I call her, and if I can fly to Tampa, I can go to Phoenix and see my little girl. And when she was 10 years old, her and her mom moved, and I told her she would never have to worry about me, that I would always come and see her, and that's what I do. And the last time I seen her, she was sitting across from me, and she had her eyes pierced, she had her nose pierced, she had her lips pierced, she had her tongue pierced, she had a tattoo on her belly, and she's looking across from me, and she said, "Daddy, what are you looking at?" And I said, "The most beautiful little girl I've ever seen in my life." Now, where would I get that at? I got that in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, where day after day, week after week, I look at all these jackasses with their piercings and their bow and arrows through their heads and everything like that, and behind every tattoo and piercing, there's an alkie in there. And that's who I talk to. And behind every one of her little tattoos and the piercings, a little girl in there, and that's who I talk to. And I always talk. And when I was with her, I said, "You know, I feel so bad that I'm not closer to you and that I can't be here when you need me as often as you need me." I says, "I wish I was closer to you. I feel so bad that I live so far." And she says, "Daddy, I wish you didn't feel that way." And I'd realize that all those visits paid off. That she loves me as much as if I lived down the street, because you wouldn't let me hide from her. The amends process is an amazing thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Amazing thing. I got a story to tell you, and then we'll go home. I got a call not too long ago from a guy in Santa Barbara Central Office. He said, "Larry, there's a guy coming out of the Georgia State Penitentiary. He's doing 20 to life. He's moving to Santa Barbara, and we don't know when he's getting out, but he's got 17 years sober. He doesn't know anybody in California, and he was wondering if maybe you could write him." And I started writing this guy in the penitentiary I'd never met. And I didn't know what to write, so I would start writing about my home group and what we do, and sitting in the third row in the third seat, and I'd start writing about our meetings. And every time I wrote this guy, and every time he'd write me back, I pictured Morgan Freeman. I don't know why, but it made it easier to write, you know what I mean? And so we eventually started writing about the steps. I wrote about my experience with the first step, and he'd write me about his experience with the first step. Well, not too long ago, we finished the 12th step. And he says, "Larry, not too long ago, we wrote about the 12th step to one another, and I got to tell you what's happened." He says, "I've never been a man to have very many dreams inside here, But he says, after we finished our 12th step, he says, I found myself out in the yard the next day, and I was watching the guys weightlift and play handball, and he said, I had a dream. And he says, I need to share with you what that dream is. And he says, that dream is one of these days I'm going to get out of here. And one of these days I'm going to take a bus to Compton, California. And on a Monday night, I'm going to take that bus to Bellflower, California. And I'm going to go to the Kiwanis Club, and I'm going to look in the third row for the third seat. And he says, I'm hoping you're there. He says, that's my dream. Well, little did he know that that's my dream. That every Monday I look at those arches that are, and I'm hoping I see Morgan, you know. And I hope I see that guy. And like that Scottish man with the pirate told me when he picked me up at the jail, when he drove me to that meeting, he said, Larry, I am so excited for you to meet the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so excited you're going to meet the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I stand here tonight in Tampa, I am so excited for him to meet the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't wait for him to meet the people. I can't wait for him to meet the people in Tampa. I can't wait for him to meet the people in my home group. I can't wait for him to see the people and become a part of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know much about God. I didn't come from a God-rearing family. I'm a stickler for evidence, though. I'm a stickler for evidence. And when I used to speak up at this guy's place up in Flagstaff, he used to have this big mansion. And his mansion was so big that no matter what window you looked out of, you've got a peak view of the mountains, whether it was the bathroom, the den, or the kitchen. And as I stand here before you in Tampa, every window of my life has got a picture. And in every picture window, you're in there. I can't think of one area of my life where I can't see the people of Alcoholics Anonymous in their faces. Their most beautiful faces. And like I said, I don't know much about God or what he looks like. All I know is on a Saturday night in Tampa, I see row after row after chair of people who should be locked up dead or insane. And look at us tonight. Look at us. We're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. I may not see his face, but by golly, we've been playing in the evidence all night long. Thank you.